Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Two Republicans who are running against each other to become Ohio's next governor have decided instead to join forces. Last week, Secretary of State John Husted ended his 2018 gubernatorial bid and agreed to play second fiddle to Mike DeWine.
If I had continued my run for governor, Mike and I would have fought a brutal campaign that would have left the winner bruised and broken with only a few months to rebuild in time for the general election.
That leaves just three Republicans vying for the nomination: DeWine, Congressman Jim Renacci, and current Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, who says she's staying in the race.
Mike DeWine is the past, and I will fight for Ohio's future. Those two individuals have been running for governor essentially since the time they were born.
Oh, okay. It's our reporter roundtable. Joining us this week, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Joe Ingles. Welcome, Joe.
It's great to be here.
Correspondent for Dayton Daily News, Laura Bischoff. Welcome.
Good morning.
And Columbus Dispatch Statehouse reporter Jim Siegel. Welcome, as always.
Good morning.
All right. So we tend to assume that candidates leave races because they determine they can't win. Was that necessarily the case for John Husted, Jim Siegel?
That definitely played into it. I mean, as much as I think John Husted could have run a very respectable race and certainly could have potentially won the race. I mean, he had a lot of money. He's a very good politician. When put up against Mike DeWine, he is, I think, 21 years younger. So he's been around a while. So he's known in a lot of the right circles for a Republican primary. But at the end of the day, Mike DeWine had the name recognition, also had the money, and would have been tough to beat. And I think at the end of the day, I guess they just decided that this would be a better path forward, and especially coming into what is expected to be a potentially difficult year for Republicans. They decided that the best way to make sure that one or both of us end up where we want to be is to join forces. I think John Husted will probably be put in charge of an agency.
They've been wanting to do in the last few years.
And I haven't heard it. I don't know. I didn't go to the press conference, so I don't know what the answer to this question was. But is Mike DeWine expected to serve two terms? I mean, he will be 71 when he gets elected.
Exactly. That was the speculation, is that they made a deal. I don't think it's not public, but there's speculation.
Husted said there was no deal.
No deal.
I mean, when he was asked afterwards, he was clear that there was no deal, that that was not part of it. I had asked him, is there going to be a special thing that John Husted's going to be doing? Is he going to take over the mantle for, doing something for the opioid crisis or something like that? And I was told that it would be, he would have a prominent place, he would have an important position, he would be consulted and included, but he really didn't have anything defined like that right now. Mm-hmm. But it did seem to me, when we talked with both of them after the event, it did certainly seem that there, if there was a deal cut, they're not going to talk about it.
Right.
Oh, yeah, that's not surprising either. Right. I can't imagine. I would have been shocked if someone had said, yes, we have a deal, and Mike DeWine is only going to serve one term, and then John Husted's going to move in. Right. Yeah, there's no way that's going to be announced right now. But it would not. Like I said, and I'm not – Mike DeWine is a very hard worker, and there's no reason – at this moment to believe he couldn't serve two terms.
Right.
But, I mean, look, he's 71, and Father Time catches up with everyone. Mm-hmm. And, at 79 would be the end of his second term at that point. So
I think actually he would hit 80 by the time his second term. His birthday's in early January.
Right, yeah, I think just, yeah, it would almost
and,
his birthday.
And John Husted just turned 50 this year, so.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Wow. I thought he was in his 40s. So.
I thought he was in his 50s.
Wow.
So what
he
do you
had
know?
A push-up contest against his campaign manager at some GOP event.
Yeah, I think it was.
You're
a committee.
Not kidding.
I'm not kidding. I'm pretty sure. John won.
It was pretty funny. Actually, Jesse Bulmer, who appears here on our show often, if you look at her Twitter feed, she actually has the video of them doing it, and it's pretty funny.
Well, heavens to Betsy. So some people were surprised that Mary
Taylor
didn't back off because of this.
No, it was interesting. She had put out a news advisory saying, I'm going to have a press conference at 3:30. And, people, I kind of thought either she's backing out or she's going to announce that she's teaming up with Jim Renacci as her lieutenant governor. And it was neither of those scenarios. It was basically bring it on. I'm still in the race and there's no way I'm backing out.
Hmm.
was the message from her.
And Renacci?
Well, he says he's still in it, too. So, you know, he says that, I mean, both Mary Taylor and Jim Renacci are kind of painting themselves as the outsiders, you know, not in government. But, I mean, he's a congressman and she's lieutenant governor. So they're not really outsiders.
There are no outsiders
in
this race.
Yeah, there are no outsiders there.
For the Republicans.
I do think that if Renacci and Taylor were to team up, they could make it a very competitive race against DeWine and Husted. Taylor and Renacci are, as Joe says, they're kind of portraying themselves as sort of the outsiders, the non-politicians. And they also are very pro-Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think that primary voters, the base GOP voter, might find a Taylor-Renacci ticket more appealing than a DeWine Husted ticket.
And separately they split it.
Right. And she did say, though, that she's open to talking about teaming up. So, you know, I don't know if she'd be teaming up with Renacci or someone else, but she's open to talking
about
that.
They do have
to
announce their lieutenant governor picks before they file. They have to file, what, February 9th?
7th.
7th or 9th. Mm-hmm. And they have to have the ticket set. And you need to get 1,000 valid voter signatures. You do not want to wait to the last second to do that.
Right.
Right, and just to remind you, you know, your listeners, it would have to be a Taylor Renacci ticket. Mary Taylor can't be lieutenant governor again; she's termed out from that position.
Right,
so she would have to lead the ticket of whatever ticket she forms up with, and I think that would be an interesting matchup to get those two together. I always find it fun when politicians try to paint themselves as outsiders. I mean, look, Mary Taylor has gone from being state representative to being state auditor to being lieutenant governor for a number of years now. Mm-hmm, painting yourself as a non-politician and an outsider is a bit of a stretch at this point, but that's the way that.
But if they say it often enough,
but I guess
you know, compared
to Mike DeWine, though, I suppose it's you seem like you have a lot less experience in government.
One little campaign pocketbook issue. Does this mean that DeWine and Husted combine their resources?
Yeah, they can do that.
They can do that, but will they?
Sure.
Okay.
In some way. I don't know the rule of how they can take their sizable campaign funds
That's
merge
a lot of
them
money,
into
yeah.
one. But obviously, they can both use their, and you know, Husted can use his fund to get the ticket elected.
Okay.
So it you know, there would be no real issue there other than, you know, maybe you'd have to write checks from two different funds, but maybe they could bring them together. I'm just not sure.
Also keep in mind, Mike DeWine loaned his campaign fund $1 million of his personal money.
Mm-hmm.
He did that in the past when he ran for attorney general and had the campaign pay him back. So it's unclear whether or not that loan will get paid back right away or if it'll be carried on the campaign account. And also Jim Renacci, you know, he played some immediate catch-up in the fundraising race by loaning his campaign $4 million of his own money.
All right. So then let's talk about the party's role in all of this. They are not going to get involved. Or
so
not.
They say.
So they say. Because I wonder, because there are really two very distinct tickets here. Let's just say Taylor and Renacci do team up. They're both pro-Trump. That's fine in a primary, but in a general, that could prove to be very, very difficult.
I don't know. Trump got elected in Ohio, didn't he?
Well, he did a year ago. A lot has happened in a year.
Well,
yeah, but
I don't know.
He won by like 6 points in Ohio.
Yeah, and the other thing is that, you know, we had that all wrong. I mean, I think most of the media, what we saw in the polling, what we what was told to us from every indicator that we could see, it didn't look like Trump was going to get elected.
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, he did. And as Laura said, by 6 points, which is hardly, you know, just a little
solid
victory.
Solid as rock. Yeah.
So, you know, obviously he tapped into something. There are people right now, you just look at social media and you can see that there are people who are continually defending President Trump on every level. Anything he says, they'll defend it.
Mm-hmm.
There are voters who are just steadfast to him. And, you know, if you've got Jim Renacci and Mary Taylor together and they are running as the Trump ticket, you know, I'm not going to count that out by any means.
I just wonder about how the electorate's changed in the last 12 months. A lot of people just didn't show up at the polls.
Yeah, but turnout is even lower in a gubernatorial than it is in the presidential year.
Right, I know that. I know. But conventional wisdom could, you know, there's two sides to that coin.
Well,
if people, you know, it went against conventional wisdom that Donald Trump was elected president, or at least the state of Ohio went for him to that extent.
But not hearing a lot of people who didn't show up saying, I'm going to show up in the governor's race. You know, maybe they will. Maybe there are people out there. I'm just not hearing it so far. I mean, I'm not hearing a lot of that.
Right now, I think Democrats are banking on the fact that the latest Gallup poll had Trump's approval rating at like 33, mm-hmm. which, I mean, we're getting
it's
down.
It's like historically low.
Yeah, we're
right?
getting down into historic low territories. And there, the hope is, from the Democratic perspective, is that the sentiment that got Trump elected, this you know, him tapping into this anger and the fact that a lot of folks really did not like Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. will have subsided by next year, and people will now take in more of what he's actually like as a leader. There will be no Hillary Clinton on the ballot for them to dislike, and the hope is that that will bring a lot more of those people who are maybe voting against Clinton and voting for what they saw as a new, fresh perspective, and those folks will come out and not vote for, you know, for the Trump type candidates, will not vote Republican, period. And that, so, you know, I don't know that. I know, you know, Husted has used some images and rhetoric that is trying to make himself more Trump like, not nearly to the extent I think that we've seen from Mary Taylor and Jim mm-hmm. Renacci, but. Everyone's going to have to try to do it, at least in the primary, though. They can't. I don't think you can completely run from Trump in a Republican primary in a state that Trump won by 8 points.
Mm-hmm. We will continue our conversation, maybe turn our direction to the Democrats coming up. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You're listening to our weekly Reporters Roundtable on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly Reporter Roundtable. We were just talking about how the GOP candidate pool for governor shrunk, but the Democratic field is expected to grow this week. Richard Cordray is expected to announce his bid for governor sometime this week. It's no big surprise. He quit his Washington position as director for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau last week. He's holding out. His holding out, however, means that he won't be joining the four other Democrats in their third debate tonight in Cleveland. The fifth Ohio Supreme Court Justice Bill O'Neill was not included, according to the Associated Press. That's because he has not yet been vetted, so he can't participate in these debates. It's our weekly Reporter Roundtable, as I said. Still with us, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Joe Ingles, Columbus Dispatch reporter Jim Siegel, and Dayton Daily News correspondent Laura Bischoff. Let's clarify for the listeners if they were trying to hear what I was saying. I jumbled that all up. We've got, for sure, at the debate tonight, Nan Whaley, Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley. We have
Joe Schiavone, State Senator from the Youngstown area, and we have Connie Pillich, former State Representative from Cincinnati, mm-hmm. and then Betty Sutton, former Congresswoman from the Akron area.
Okay.
So those are the four that are in the debate, and the four that had the debate in the previous mm-hmm. in the previous debates. The fifth would be Ohio Supreme Court Justice Bill O'Neill. He has not gone through this process that the Ohio Democratic Party has, so he did not get into the debate, and I think he's appealing to the City Club, which is the host of the debate, to try to get in. And then Cordray is not announced, so he's not in either. Right. And the other thing is these debates are, you know, they call it a debate, but really it's a pretty friendly forum in which to kind of showcase the candidates and get some media attention to them mm-hmm. so they don't have to spend any money.
This is the second one, right?
I think this is third.
The Democrats.
It's the third.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is notable. I mean, that's good. It's good. But why won't Bill O'Neill be vetted? What's the problem?
I don't know. You know, he had said that if Rich Cordray runs, he didn't want to run. And I think it's pretty clear right now that Rich Cordray is going to run. It's just a matter of when he's going to announce it. And if that's the case, Bill O'Neill might not run. I mean, according to what he said before.
Well, let's face it, the Democratic Party has exactly zero interest in Bill O'Neill being in this governor's race.
He's the
only Democrat on the Supreme Court right now. They really don't want to see him step off the Supreme Court to take a Don Quixote run at running for governor and then allowing Governor Kasich to fill the Supreme Court seat. So
it would be a 50% reduction in the Democrats holding statewide office because right now it's only Bill O'Neill and Sherrod Brown.
Yes.
Right. And the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, they don't have much to go with.
And Bill O'Neill's recent self-admitted gaffe on Facebook.
Yeah, let's review.
Yeah.
So he posted on his Facebook page that he was speaking for all heterosexual males to say that basically he was going to save his opponent's research time and just admit right now that he has gone to bed with 50 beautiful women in the past.
And beautiful.
Very beautiful women. And he went into some detail.
About some of them.
About some of them. Some identifying details. And then it was just so politically tone deaf, given the national conversation about sexual harassment and sexual assault. And he confused consensual sexual contact with assault and harassment, which also I thought was tone deaf. And it caused a huge firestorm, national headlines, a big embarrassment for him. He apologized. And that, again, was a little ham-handed. And then he apologized a second time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a great – that and also, being on the Supreme Court, he faces some question about whether or not he can run for an executive office while he's on the court, mm-hmm. on the bench. And so he's not had a good beginning to this race.
Yeah, and some may be sitting out there going, well, how did this guy get elected to the Supreme Court with those kind of doing those kind of things? Well, he welcome to our judicial election system in the state of Ohio. We elect people on nonpartisan ballots, which is ridiculous. We don't let them say anything of any substance. Bill O'Neill, frankly, didn't even raise any money. He just won based because his name was O'Neill and. And
people like
and
the
they like that
O'Neill.
Name better than was it Cup that he beat
Bob Cup?
Yeah, Bob Cup.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, keep in mind on the Ohio Supreme Court we have O'Neill, O'Connor, O'Donnell, and Kennedy.
And we see a
now. I'm Irish, there. And go Irish. But
well, I mean, it's those names have always been popular names in Ohio,
right.
Along with Brown,
right?
A few others.
I think Cordray is trying to change his name to O'Cordray.
So O'Neill, we don't know. I mean, he may be just why bother to be vetted if you're going to drop out if Cordray goes into it.
Right.
Who knows what will come up?
Well, he's not raising any money. You might be able to slip into a Supreme Court race because of certain circumstances, but I can't imagine he'll be any factor in the governor's race in the Democratic primary without raising money and doing. Plus heaping a bunch of controversy on himself that's self-inflicted.
How big of a deal is this race coming up in 2018? Not just the governor's race, but down ticket as well.
It's a big deal.
Is it going to be competitive this year?
Well,
I don't. It's been so long.
I don't know if it'll be competitive. I don't know who will get out and vote. I can't even predict that. But I'll tell you why I think it's a big deal is that it is going to show us just where the philosophy is, I think. We're going to see, are people tired of Trump or are they not tired of Trump? Do they want to embrace those policies? Do they not? If we see a groundswell of people who didn't vote in the presidential election going toward Cordray or whoever the Democrat is, if we see that, I think it's telling to us as to what Ohioans, if they're getting out and voting in an election that they wouldn't ordinarily vote in, and they're voting against whoever it is that they perceive as the Trump ticket, that's a telling piece right there. Plus, I think as Laura and Jim just pointed out, Democrats are very underrepresented in state government right now. And we don't have a single Democrat in elected statewide office except for Bill O'Neill.
And Sherrod Brown,
and Sherrod Brown who's at the congressional level or the Senate, U.S. Senate. So as far as the statewide offices, I mean, it's just Bill O'Neill. Right
well, not
now.
Only is it taking the temperature of the voters on how they feel about the Trump administration, but also, I mean, you know, this at stake is a seat in the U.S. Senate. There's congressional seats, legislative races, judicial seats, governor, attorney general, auditor, secretary of state, treasurer of state. And also, you know, we're in the process of changing how we're going to draw legislative districts. But, you know, the census comes up in 2020. So
right. There'll
be a say in how the lines are drawn.
And I think that's going to be fun to watch because, you know, we could possibly even have two issues on the ballot at this point because we have the citizens group that's out there collecting
and
signatures.
And say that they won't, no matter what, they're not going to stop.
Right. And then we've got the legislators who really don't like citizens groups dictating, you know, this kind of thing. So they're trying to come up with their own plan, which would, you know, if they get it, go on the ballot. So, I mean, we could possibly see a really nasty battle over redistricting. And, you know, I think that I love it when we talk about redistricting in the public because I think it's one of those things that everyone's eyes glaze over. But
not
it
as much as it used
everything.
To, though.
Yeah.
I think more and more people are starting to understand the redistricting issue.
I think so. I think you're right. But I think, you know, bringing it out and talking about it more is a good thing, you know.
Anyway, 2018 is a huge election
year. Huge year.
Yeah.
Huge election.
A lot at stake.
Okay. So Cordray will announce this week. What do we know?
That's the expectation that he's supposed to announce this week. The last I had heard that he would not announce today, Monday, but that it could come any time, you know, during the rest of the
week. Do you think he'll have a ticket together or not necessarily?
I doubt it. I don't know anything for sure, but I would be surprised if he already had a running mate set up because, like I said, he very well could try to do just kind of what DeWine and Husted did and form up with one of the current candidates running in the Democratic primary. I think we were kind of talking off air. I think many of us agree that he probably will almost have to pick a woman.
Why is that?
In order to balance that ticket out and to show because, you know, this especially in the year that we've been dealing with the sexual harassment issues and things and just the fact that, you know, Hillary Clinton lost and despite winning the popular vote, I just think there's a lot of sentiment out there to see, you know, to see a woman, elevated and and put on the ticket, especially on the Democratic side.
Yeah.
For that to happen, women are very, are much more key to the Democrats' victories than they are to the Republicans. And so I would be surprised. I would be very surprised personally if whoever wins is not either one of the women currently running or is not a man with a woman as the lieutenant governor.
There certainly is a big opportunity here for Ohio to elect its first woman governor, though, if Mary Taylor stays in the race and is running as on the gubernatorial ticket. If Sutton, Pillich, or Whaley make it through the Democratic primary. You know, in Ohio history, we've only had one woman as a governor. It was Nancy Hollister, who served for 9 days when she was lieutenant governor, and Voinovich moved on to the Senate. She plugged a gap there. And then also in Ohio history, there's only been one woman who has served in any of the big three political positions, the Senate president, the speaker, or the governor, and it's been Joanne Davidson. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, the power structure has been firmly in the hands of men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think being a woman will be a big thing. But I think he'll also, if it is Cordray, and if one of the women don't rise to that rank, I think he'll be also looking for a woman who has strong connections to Ohio and what has been going on here in the last few years. Because you've got to remember, Cordray's been in Washington. He's been out of Ohio for a little bit. Now he's an Ohioan. And you know,
I can't imagine he's lost that much touch. But
he hasn't lost that much touch, but he'll want to have someone who has their finger on the, you know, knows exactly what's going on. He'll want to have that person standing with him, I think. I that's just the gap I think that he'll look for.
He had a noisy exit from Washington. There's still litigation out there over who succeeds him. during this interim period before the president makes a formal nomination for a replacement, and then I would imagine it's a Senate committee has to approve it. I frankly can't remember. But does that help him or hurt him?
What help him?
The noisy exit from Washington, the ongoing litigation on that.
I think we're going to have to wait and see on that. But it's, I mean, going against, you know, butting heads with Donald Trump, I don't think is going to hurt him at all in a primary, obviously.
Right.
And frankly, probably won't hurt him too much in a general because, you know, the side he's on the consumer side in this debate. I mean, you can argue whether or not what the regulations that the bureau he ran are good or not, or whether they're actually going to work. But I mean, he had a role of fighting for consumers and mm-hmm. fighting to protect them from the banks, from the payday lenders and others. And so, you know, it's not as I don't think it's, you know, the electorate doesn't see it quite as divisive an issue to say, you know, whether something like if he ran the EPA, I think that's a different argument than if you're running an organization aimed strictly at protecting, you know, consumers and keeping them from getting ripped off.
And we're seeing a lot of people right now, especially with the tax reform that's going on in Washington, we're seeing a lot of people who are taking issue with it and not happy about the way it's structured. If those people, if he's able to tap into those people, again, with his consumers, ordinary Ohioans, middle class Ohioans, you're getting messed over by this tax cut, that kind of thing. If he goes and does that, that's another positive for him on the stump when he's campaigning. Hmm. Because I think the last polling I saw, there was around 30 to 35% support in the polls, and again, these are just polls.
Right.
But 30 to 35% saying that they supported the tax reform. So if that becomes unpopular, it could really hurt in 2018.
Hmm. Yeah, Laura.
Oh, I was just going to say if I think Rich Cordray has a good story to tell on fighting for the little guy through the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But the key is to translate it into like human stories to show that this helped, you know, Bob and Betty Buckeye. Because otherwise it sounds like an alphabet soup of, mm-hmm. you know, the CFPB.
And the Democrats are not well known for being able to make their case and you know, showcase their achievements.
Right. So that'll be the challenge.
Not in Ohio, they have it.
Not in Ohio, right? Yeah. So the debate tonight at the City Club, it's scheduled for 6:30 p.m. How many people will be watching it? Who cares?
I don't know.
Are you guys watching it?
Yeah, I'm paid to watch it.
Okay.
I will watch it later. I'm teaching class during that time.
Somebody in my office is paid to watch it.
Like I said, these are friendly forums to really kind of showcase their candidates and kind of gin up some excitement and some interest in the race.
Let's turn our sights to an issue that is percolating at the State House now. Jim Siegel, payday lending. They're monkeying with that again. They're trying to lower those rates again. A lot of voters thought they took care of that a few years ago on the ballot.
Yeah, the law that was passed in 2008 and was upheld by voters by a very wide margin has failed. It's a complete failure as a law. There are exactly zero payday lenders operating under the Short-Term Loan Act that was created in 2008 because they were simply able to establish themselves under different areas of law, Mortgage Lending Act, credit service organization sections of law that were never written with payday lenders in mind, but mm-hmm. they were able to maneuver them, you know, themselves into those and continue charging fairly high rates. So that's where we are. We basically passed a law that didn't work, and there are some groups and some lawmakers, including Representative Kyle Kaler out of the see the Dayton area? Yeah, Springfield.
Springfield.
Sorry. And then Representative Ashford, Michael Ashford from up in the Toledo area, just have combined up. Democrat Ashford, Republican Kaler have combined up to try to push a new legislation. They've got there's at least one coalition out there pushing this, religious leaders and others saying, look, we continue to see the same problems we saw in 2008 when this passed the first time. You got a number of folks who are desperate for money. They don't have access to credit for short-term loans like this. They go to a payday lender. They're asked to repay the loan, $500, let's say, in 2 weeks. They can't do it because if you don't have $500 today, very likely you don't have $500 2 weeks from now. Mm-hmm. So they take out another loan to pay off the first, and then they get in a cycle. And they end up just charging, having to pay more fees each time. And they end up in what's commonly called a cycle of debt. And so they end up taking 6, 8, 12 loans before they're finally out. And they end up paying a ton of fees by the end of the – but, you know, that $500 loan ends up costing them over $1,000 or more.
Right. And there's hundreds of these shops all across Ohio. They're easier to find than a McDonald's, really.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Speaker Rosenberger gave this bill, House Bill 123 – its first hearing was introduced in March, and it mm-hmm. took this long for it to get its first hearing. And he indicated during the press gaggle last week that he's willing to give it some consideration, and that there needs to be some changes to the payday lending law. But they wouldn't articulate what those changes might be, and if auto title loans would be covered under the bill as well. Auto title loans is sort of a new product out for the last year or two. In which
it's been a little bit longer than that, but it's proliferated.
But basically, if you put up the title to your car as collateral for one of these loans, it's particularly bad if you're already struggling, and your car is your only way to get to work.
And it's the same process. Sorry, it's the same process. You just end up with a title loan. Right. You just end up rolling over the loan if mm-hmm. you can't pay it back, and you end up paying more fees each time until either you pay it off or
you lose your car.
And I mean, just to give people a sense of what we're talking about here, as far as the interest on these loans, it is really, really high. It's 600 up to
like 591% APR.
Yeah.
And you know, the law that was approved in 2008 by the voters capped it at 28%.
That's what
APR.
I got.
Right. Right. It did. But the effective rate, they're using this 591, as Laura said, that's what it ends up being. And when you're talking about rolling over loans with all the fees and stuff that go on it, they end up getting a lot of money.
So expectations that anything's going to be moving on this? It's a Democrat, right?
And a Republican. Kyle Kaler is a Republican from Springfield. And I have gotten the sense from people I've talked to, because there have been behind-the-scenes efforts to try to hammer something out here with this bill. The payday lending lobby is strong in Ohio. Mm-hmm. They give a lot of money. They give more to Republicans, but they also give to Democrats as well. And it's an issue that is politically difficult for both caucuses, both Republican and Democrats. Republicans, you have a contingent of folks who just don't like business regulation. They like free market. So they're very reluctant to place more restrictions on these types of things. They just want to let the free market handle it, which supporters of the bill say that doesn't work when people are desperate. And then on Democratic side, you have a number of folks concerned about access to credit, that a number of these poor folks, particularly in some of the urban areas, just don't have access to credit. The banks have left them. This is their only way to get a loan if they want one. And so there's concern about having them shut down. Now, supporters of the House Bill 123 say, well, this is kind of the best of both worlds. We will reduce the fees that you're allowed to charge. We will set a cap on how much you're allowed to let them – to require them to pay back each month, mm-hmm. which is like 5% of their pay, which would help them not go into further debt. And they're saying they're saying a similar law has been in place in Colorado for years, mm-hmm. and there are a number of payday lenders still operating there. So this is a way to keep them open, but keep them open and not setting up a system where low-income folks are just spiraling into debt.
There's also some push by Republicans who say, you know, maybe we need more consumer education about what these loans cost and how they operate, and, you know, maybe we should require that. And Kyle Kaler says, well, that's nice, but when somebody is drowning, it's not the time to offer them swimming lessons.
Right.
You know, you need to throw them a lifeline and mm-hmm. pull them out of the water.
Hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I think any education is always good.
Right.
But I mean, I've done stories in the past where, I mean, I stood in line with people getting payday loans, and to each one of them told me roughly the same story. I'm so glad this payday loan store is here. I'm so glad they're here to give me money when I need it. And then I would ask them, well, so are you here to pay your loan off? They're like, no, I'm just getting another one. And to every and I was like, oh, how many have you done? Oh, this is my fifth one. Oh, this is my sixth one. This is my fourth one. But and they don't realize so much that because of the situation they're in, that's not foremost in their mind that they're having to keep paying these fees.
They're just trying to get the bills paid.
They're just trying to get the bills paid and get on to the next week. And so that's why they're saying that's why the argument of we can't just let free market and education do the job here. Because when people are desperate and the choice is between do I fix my car and go to work or not, that's where you the government needs to step in and put some, as they like to call it at the State House, put some guardrails up to keep keep people from flying off the road.
The bigger issue here, and most people who work with poor folks will tell you that a lot of times they're just robbing Peter to pay Paul anyway. Every month they're trying to figure out which bill do I pay, which bill can I put off. So that mentality of having four or five or six loans, that just kind of fits in with what they do with the rest of the budget sometimes, you know?
Situation normal.
Yeah.
We will continue our conversation. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. And with me in the studio, Joe Engels of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Let's turn now to the issue of medical marijuana. Last week, the state released the list of the 12 winners, the companies that were granted large-scale cultivation licenses. That was out of a pool of 109. Laura, you reported on this. What's the deal?
Well, so you get 12 large-scale growers. They're allowed to have up to 25,000 square feet of cultivation space. The 12 small-scale growers are also set. They get like up to 3,000 square feet of cultivation space. They have to build out on a pretty tight time frame. They have to be ready to go. And I talked to one company, Cresco, which actually has a couple of political guys connected to it. Chris Schrimpf, who was the spokesman for the Ohio GOP and worked on the Kasich presidential campaign, and Troy Judy and Chad Hawley from the Batchelder Group. They both were aides to Bill Batchelder. They're in that they're part owners. Anyway, they said that they're going to be able to have their cultivation site built out in Yellow Springs in like 5 months. They're going to be but at the same time, there's, you know, you get 12 winners and then 97 rejects, and some of them are not happy. Ian James and Jimmy Gold, I think their company's called Canascend. Mm-hmm. They were disqualified for failing to meet the, you know, minimum requirements of all the elements. And they're not happy, and they're threatening a lawsuit. And this is very typical that happened in other states where, you know, they announce the winners, and then all the losers are unhappy, and then there's litigation. And so it's unclear how that might impact the rollout of the whole industry.
One thing that was noticeable is there's none in Central Ohio.
Right. There's none in Franklin County. Absolutely none.
What's the explanation for that?
I don't know. I don't know why.
Well, there's not an abundance of farmland, for one thing, in Franklin County.
True.
But I mean, not that that's the only reason, but that's...
They can do it indoor.
Well, actually, all of these are going to be indoor.
Oh, they're all indoor?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Never mind.
So farmland...
is irrelevant.
You don't want to... They're going to be growing, you know, 24/7, 365, and they can't have their fields, outdoor fields...
getting snowed on.
Unproductive in January, February.
Right.
Marijuana doesn't grow well in the snow,
and
I guess.
There's lots of empty buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So... lawsuits ahead, probably.
Yep.
And where are we in the process? I mean, everything's supposed to be up and running by next September.
Correct. Right. And they have, they have processor licenses. I think the application window opened last Friday, maybe?
Yeah.
So the processor licenses, those are going to be those applications will be accepted and reviewed. Dispensary licenses, those have been received, and they're going to be awarded. I think that's probably the next round. The program is it's regulated by three state agencies: Board of Pharmacy, Medical Board, and Department of Commerce. And so it's a lot of moving parts.
Right. What now? It says these are the large scale cultivation licenses. Are there small scale cultivation licenses? Mm-hmm.
Right. Those are the other 12 that were announced in early November, and they'll be allowed to do up to 3,000 square feet of grow space. I think in total, Ohio, if everybody uses every square foot they're allowed to do at the initial rollout, it'll be like 330,000 square feet or so. I didn't do the math, but...
Yeah, I don't do math either.
Any more clarity as far as recommending it? Who recommends it? Doctors? How that's going to work? Because they can't prescribe it.
Right. There's no prescribing. It's more like getting a doctor's note for it. And there's going to be, the state medical board will handle that end of things, having the doctors, get their certification or however they're going to do that. That could prove to be a little bit of a bottleneck initially in the system, because I think, doctors are going to be maybe a little bit more reluctant to just jump into this.
How have they done it in other states?
There's some that do it similar, but there's some states that are just free for all.
It seems like Michigan never had a problem rolling that out. That wasn't.
I think Ohio's regulations are going to be a little more tightly controlled than Michigan's.
Yeah.
Okay. Michigan was a newbie at it. All right. So
I think the other thing is too, if we continue to see some of this discontent, certainly in the news release that Ian James put out from Jimmy Gold the other day. Now, Jimmy Gold was the financier in the 2015 Responsible Ohio marijuana issue that voters shot down on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Ian worked with him at that point. But they in the end of it, they kind of hinted that, hey, we don't want to take this thing back to the ballot, but these guys, they're just not doing this right, and we may have to. So I think we want to watch out and see if there's more discontent along the way. We may very well be seeing another marijuana issue on the ballot in the future.
Hmm. All right. And any walking, talking buds? Well, or do you think that's
Buddy, the mascot?
Right. Yeah, Buddy the mascot.
Probably
the superhero marijuana mascot.
Yeah.
I do not think we're going to see that.
I don't either.
From the state of Ohio.
All right. So what are you guys covering this week? Christmas is coming. Holidays are coming. Things should be slowing down, but seems like it never does anymore.
Well, Ohio Public Radio will have an opioid series. It'll start on the TV side this weekend, and we'll be having some on radio talking about the opioid problem in Ohio, which is pretty huge.
Okay. Jim Siegel?
Yeah, I mean, we're just keeping an eye on what's going on around, waiting for the Richard Cordray announcement that's expected this week, and also just keeping an eye on a couple legislative things, some abortion bills and others that, they tend to like to wrap some of these things up before the end of the calendar year, even though it has no real... The end of the calendar year doesn't really mean anything in a two-year session.
It's not a lame duck session.
Right. But sometimes you'll see some of that stuff flow.
Because people aren't paying as close of attention?
I don't know. People set arbitrary deadlines in order to get things passed, and that's sometimes it's just what happens at the end of the December.
What kind of abortion issues?
There's a Down syndrome bill.
Oh, that's right.
That's a big one. If your child has Down syndrome, both chambers have passed one. They'd have to finish it off. Now by just deciding which version they're going to go with.
It's in a conference committee or?
No. They're the same. Basically the same
exactly
bills.
Same.
They just
have
to decide who's going to get credit for it.
And then,
there's a number of, kind of ongoing issues that the lawmakers are working on. Congressional redistricting, which we talked about a little bit. The unemployment compensation fund has been chronically broken. Too much money going out, not enough money going in. And this is something that labor and business and political factions have all been kind of hashing out for a long time. And I think the House has a bill pending, and I think they're going to try and move it and see what the Senate does with it. That'll be a big one. And then
because winter is coming. I mean, there's going to be another recession. There's going to be another downturn.
Sure, eventually. And, you know, the fund went broke, and the state had to borrow billions of dollars from the federal government in mm-hmm. order to keep it going, and then ended up paying, I think, like $200+ million in interest to pay off the loan. So it's very costly for state taxpayers to, you know, have this not fixed.
Mm-hmm.
That fund is barely holding on in the best of times,
yes,
too.
Yes, exactly.
It barely meets its obligations even when the unemployment rate is where it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bill Beagle, a state senator from Tip City over near Dayton, he's got a bill to revamp how child support is calculated. Believe it or not, the formula used to calculate child support is, I think, from the 1980s.
It would have to be, well, probably around the late 80s, because I remember that was a big deal back then.
Yeah, it's still not fixed. So that's another chronic problem that they're trying to update. So there's, you know, even though it's not the end of a legislative session.
A legislative seizure?
Yeah, seizure. There's certainly plenty of stuff going into the holiday season. The debate tonight, Cordray, the abortion bill, child support bill, unemployment comp.
The unemployment compensation fund has been kind of fascinating. This bill has had exactly zero people step up and testify for or against it so far. And you could tell in the gaggle with reporters last week, we call it the gaggle when the House session is done, the speaker will come down and talk to reporters.
Mm-hmm.
He was annoyed by it. You could just sense that he was annoyed about the lack of engagement by publicly on both sides, and because he kind of just said, well, look, if no one's going to talk about it, we'll just put it up for a vote, and you know, it's sort of like, yeah, we'll see how they like that. If they're not going to come out and tell us what they wanted, what they want changed, or
who are the vested interests? Is it like the business groups, the
businesses,
business, labor, and politicians?
Yeah,
okay.
A lot of the trade unions, I mean, it's all a very fascinating behind the scenes debate, mm-hmm. too, because the trade unions have in the last few years been giving a lot of money to Republicans to make sure that they get a fair, you know, what they see as a fair deal on these types of bills. The business groups, you know, everyone's kind of digging in their heels, and this is a bill that neither side likes a ton, but. So that those kind of situations don't make politicians very happy when they can't at least go to one side or the other and claim a victory. And then they're all busy looking at each other going, well, why would we vote for this if no one's going to congratulate us for it, if they're all going to hate us?
But again, it's expensive if it goes unfixed.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's it.
That's it. Let's go get them.
Let's go get them, gang. That is Laura Bischoff, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News. Also, Jim Siegel, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
To be here. Yeah.
Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lynette, All Sides interns Kyle McKinnon, Courtney Gilbert, Dan Posniak, and Martin Coleman, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.